thank you very much, Dan. Well, Dan, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your very warm welcome. And I am indeed honored by the presence of everybody who is here today. Dan, I'd like to start off by thanking you for your extremely kind and generous introduction. And in many ways, being here at Eglinton St. George's United Church is a kind of a return having spent many happy years at Eglinton. And as I look around the room, there are so many people that I know and whose presence again does me great honor. We're very well represented by members of the bench. I see retired Judge Hulock, and one of the great choir members, Robert Blair of the Court of Appeal, and Mac Austin, and I think others. There are so many people I'd like to mention in the room. John Fowler, I haven't seen in many years, and of course Annie Hull, who has been such a part of our life for so many generations, and see Bill Trudell sitting there in front of Bill. I should mention David McFadden, because he's not only one of my senior partners, he's succeeded me as the member for Eglinton in the Ontario Legislature a few years ago. And there, Mac Austin is there, I think I always said, so many other people. But I think if I start going through, I'm going to, of course, miss a few people, and that is never a very happy occurrence. But at any event, I'm delighted to join your Eglinton St. George Speaker's Seminar entitled A Justice System for a Just Society. It is, of course, a subject that has been of tremendous importance to me, given my almost 60 years in the criminal justice system in Ontario. And while I have been a lawyer for about 56 years, and therefore qualify as one of the antiques of the profession, my experience in the justice system actually began while I was a second-year law student doing pro bono criminal cases, long before a fee-for-service legal aid system was created in 1967. When I was called to the bar in 1958, the penalty of capital punishment still existed. And while it was not formally abolished until some years later, the last death penalties in Canada being imposed in Toronto in 1961 when two long-term thugs and killers were executed, I have to say at that time that I was quite conflicted emotionally by the retention of the death penalty. However, I was even more emotionally affected when I met shortly thereafter an 18-year-old delivery driver by the name of Fitton, only 18 years old, was on death row and was introduced to me by his lawyer, the late Justice David Humphrey. Young Fitton looked about 14 years old, but he was executed, and it actually took me years to get his face out of my memory. Shortly thereafter, I began to work with Arthur Maloney to create the Canadian Society for the Abolition of the Death Penalty. And in this regard, I was assisted mightily by Ken Bagnell, who's with us, who was a very strong and active supporter through the United Church and was a great a great teammate. But in any event, our initiative created considerable controversy, and the supporters of the death penalty became a very vocal segment of society, and they probably did represent the great majority of Canadians. At a meeting of parliamentarians in Ottawa in 1968, I recall then provincial Liberal cabinet minister, Quebec cabinet minister René Lévesque's eloquent statement to the parliamentarians. In closing, he urged them to show the way to a society in need of progress by eliminating this penalty, by taking this first step. This is one of the most important steps that must be taken, said René, before the monkey who one day became a man may finally come out of the jungle and stand up on his hind legs and not fall back on his front paws and revert to his primitive state, but become truly more civilized. I've always long retained that eloquent statement. But needless to say, the justice system of today bears very little resemblance to that far-off day when I first entered court as a defense counsel. While we have strengthened our just society in Canada, there are certainly many challenges that remain, and ones that will not disappear without huge efforts and financial resources, which simply may not be available given the vast number of competing priorities. And when I state competing priorities, I regret to state that our justice system, while comparing very favorably with most other jurisdictions, has never been a government priority like health care and education, to name but two of many major government responsibilities. When it came to justice as Attorney General, I became more and more aware that most voters paid little attention to the justice system until they had read about some horrendous crime or had been caught up in a civil lawsuit, which often can be prolonged and expensive and therefore regrettably very memorable. At the same time, I would like to emphasize that our justice system has improved over the decades that I have personally witnessed it. In my earliest years at the bar, the provincially appointed criminal court judges were not lawyers, had no formal legal education. They were known as magistrates and more often were veterans of court's administration before their appointment as a judge. Now, my recollection is generally of very conscientious individuals, but the legally trained Crown prosecutor clearly had an edge in the courtroom. As Attorney General, I had the opportunity of appointing the first female criminal court judge in Ontario to the provincial court, as well as the first black judge to that court. Needless to say, the system is still trying to catch up in making the system more representative of the public that it serves. The most important positive change during my own legal career has been the dramatic increase of women lawyers since 1970. Before then, women represented a very small percentage of the profession, and the dramatic growth of the number of women in the legal profession and as members of the judiciary has, of course, been of crucial, vital importance to the quality of our justice system in Ontario and in Canada generally. In my opinion, the two principal challenges facing the justice system in Canada are access to justice in civil matters and more caring and balanced criminal justice, By access to justice, I mean the availability of legal assistance to the citizen of average financial means. In my first speech as Attorney General in 1975, I stated that access to justice would be the principal, in my view, would be the principal challenge for the civil justice system in the years ahead. And while I made this statement almost 40 years ago, it is generally agreed that the challenge has exacerbated and that there are now more self-represented litigants in civil courts than ever before, particularly in family disputes. An early resolution of these disputes, family disputes, is obviously of vital importance given the role of families as the fundamental structure of our society. Ontario created a legal aid system in 1967 for both civil and criminal matters, but the legal aid resources are badly stretched at the best of times, and many lawyers are reluctant to work for the very modest fees available. As Attorney General, I created the current legal aid clinic system with the cooperation of the governing body of the legal profession. There are approximately 78 legal clinics in Ontario, each with their own community boards. Most of Ontario's law schools also have student legal aid societies. The majority of law students who become involved in legal aid in university and law school become very committed to the concept and certainly wish to provide pro bono assistance as lawyers. However, many are burdened with unpaid student loans, and with most law firms committed to the billable hours targets, the opportunity for pro bono assistance can become severely limited. Working with leaders of the, again with leaders of the legal profession 12 years ago, we created the first pro bono, formal pro bono office to identify for opportunities for lawyers to volunteer their services. It has provided a great deal of assistance, but far short of the actual needs. As I have stated publicly on many occasions, the legal profession has taken a long time to determine whether it is fundamentally a helping profession or just another business. And the economic realities of today suggest that the business priority will likely prevail. There's not a shortage of lawyers currently in Ontario, and I believe a large number of them would be prepared to accept lower incomes if their work had more meaning in the context of public and community service. In a more perfect world, I believe that there should be a large network of specialized legal aid clinics created to serve the public. The work would be performed on a pro bono basis or for affordable fees and by paid lawyers, staff lawyers. However, I am not confident that we will see government support for a larger network of legal services in the foreseeable future. During my early years in the legal profession, I did a large amount of pro bono criminal defense work, as did many other lawyers. As I had been a lawyer for 9 years before the Ontario Legal Aid Certificate Plan was established, my efforts did not represent an undue commitment of time, as criminal trials in particular were in those days of a much briefer duration than in later years, when the culture of advocacy changed somewhat, as well with the constitutional entrenchment of a Charter of Rights. During my early years as a lawyer, I was frequently questioned about whether I saw a serious ethical problem in representing an accused whom I believed to be guilty, or at least morally guilty. My explanation always was that the most fundamental principle of our criminal law is that every accused person is presumed innocent until their guilt is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, a large number of people were not satisfied by my response, believing that the lawyer had a moral duty to believe in his client's innocence before a plea of not guilty was entered, which, of course, is not the fundamental law of our nation. Now, while it is well established in law that every accused person is entitled to enter a plea of not guilty, this process, I should also say, should happen within an ethical context. As an example, a lawyer should not call his client or any other witness to give evidence if the lawyer knows that the evidence would be false and would therefore amount to perjury. Many people are frustrated by the criminal law process, and while usually reluctant to admit it, believing that there should be a greater degree of expediency in the trial process. In this context, I often think of one of my favorite passages in literature, namely the exchange between Sir Thomas More, the Lord Chancellor of England, and his future son-in-law, a young man by the name of Roper, in Sir Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, which many of you will recall was made into a famous film. In the particular scene, the young man, Roper, argues the proposition that the villain of the play should be arrested, as he is clearly evil, and therefore, in his words, offends the law of God. "Then let God arrest him," replies Sir Thomas, and goes on to state that he would, quote, "be prepared to allow the devil himself go free until he broke the law of man." The young Roper is furious at that response and states that in order to get after the devil, he'd be prepared to cut down every law in England. Similar sentiments which we occasionally hear even today. But Sir Thomas ends the exchange by stating, "And if the laws were down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide? Yes, this country is planted thick with law from coast to coast, man's laws and not God's. And if you cut them all down, do you really think that you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake." In my view, Sir Thomas's reply represents the traditional respect as to the value of the rule of law in a democratic society. And I occasionally read, as you all do, criticisms of the entrenchment of a charter of rights in our Constitution. There are many who believe that unelected judges should not be allowed to strike down laws passed by elected legislators, perhaps forgetting that it was a decision of Parliament and not judges to entrench the charter. And while the Charter has extended the length of some criminal trials, I believe that its general impact has resulted in the strengthening of respect in Canada for both individual and collective rights, and a greater sensitivity in relation to our nation's diversity. My 10 years as an Attorney General and more than 16 years as a Chief Justice in Ontario has given me, I think, a unique opportunity to observe and assess our justice system. And I believe that the public is well served by the women and men who serve very conscientiously as judges in all of our courts. Furthermore, I cannot recall a single instance of alleged corruption by any judge which is significant given the reality in most of the rest of the world. While occasionally unreasonable decisions are reached, they are not as a result of any lack of independence from government or the litigants before them. And while Canadians take this reality for granted as the necessary foundation stone for a democratic society, this fact is simply not enjoyed by the majority of people in our often unhappy world. Official statistics in Canada and elsewhere in the Western world demonstrate a steady decline in serious crime. However, our federal government simply states that it does not believe the statistics and has embarked on a tougher on crime agenda with longer mandatory minimum sentences, for example, which will require the building of additional prisons. Now, this is occurring at a time when even the most right-wing politicians in the United States have concluded that its more than 30-year tough-on-crime agenda, which has more than doubled, if not tripled, its prison population, has been an absolute failure. And the reduction of the U.S. prison populations has now become a political priority in the U.S. And notwithstanding their duty to follow the laws enacted by Parliament, in December, the Globe and Mail published a feature article entitled "The New Face of Judicial Defiance" by justices across Canada opposed to the conservative crime agenda, particularly as it affects poor offenders. A 70-year-old judge who was appointed almost 30 years earlier spoke of his general emotions when he read the pre-sentence reports that contain the life stories of the men and women who appear before him. And I quote, "It was often like fiction," he stated. "I couldn't believe the desperate backgrounds of some of these people. From the day they were born, they were behind the eight ball." This judge's sentiments echo my own experiences, and given the challenges faced by a number of our young people, in particular, one could well speculate that our society is indeed fortunate that our crime rates are not significantly higher. And when I think of the poverty faced by so many in Canada, I often reflect on the words of the French philosopher Anatole France, who wrote, and I quote, who wrote of the majestic equality of the law, that equally forbade both the rich and the poor to sleep under bridges, steal a loaf of bread, or beg for alms in the street. In reality, the gap between the rich and the poor is widening in Canada, but this is not something that we hear much from our federal government. The word compassion apparently is not in its lexicon. While we hear a good deal of rhetoric about getting tough on crime, we hear little about crime prevention programs or initiatives to keep young people in school. And when it comes to the young people in school and young offenders, there's a Roy McMurtry Youth Center in Brampton, which contains a school that has the model simply that education is liberation. And without question in my mind, that is the way to go. Now, government continue, whenever there is a crisis, government decides they'll have a study and a report which nine times out of ten gets buried and is never seen again. And when the young black high school student was shot to death in the C.W. Jeffries School, Jordan Manners was his name, the Premier asked myself, working with Alvin Curling, the first black speaker, to do a report into the roots of the review of the roots of youth justice. And we had a good team of researchers, and we came out with a report a year and a half later, and we're a four-volume report, which the government praised from the heights and then quickly decided to ignore it until another crisis would arise. And then their response would be, well, we have the answer. It's in the Roots of Youth Violence report by McMurtry and Curling, and it provides the strategy and whatnot for dealing with these issues. And then there's a silence. And then you may recall a couple of years ago there was these shootings at a party in Scarborough where a number of people were injured and a couple of people killed. And then once again they trotted our report out and said, well, you know, we have the answers, the strategy in that report. Now, I'm not being overly critical of the provincial government. As a matter of fact, I'm rather fond of the present premier and wish her well. But the difficulty is that governments, in my experience over many years, are unable to measure the effectiveness of prevention. They can tell us how many people spend a year in jail in Ontario or correctional institute, or they can tell you how many people spend a day or more in hospital in Ontario. But they can't tell you as to how many people are prevented from going to jail or going to hospital because of community prevention. Initiatives. Now, that's a reality for all governments, but it does, I think, indicate to us that the public needs to be much more active in providing opportunities for these young people. And the review, the executive summary of the review of Roots Violence is on the website. And if any of you are interested in it, it's not a difficult read. And what we are recommending is, to me, just straight common sense that is not complicated. And we started this in Toronto a few years ago, and that is identify your priority areas. Identify the places where people are poor and where assistance is needed, and organize your community resources in such a way as to deal with those issues. And it's all there, and it quite frankly frustrates the hell out of me that somebody won't sort of pick up the ball and run with it. Now, for example, in the criminal justice system in Ontario, there are three ministries who have responsibility for the youth criminal justice system, I should say. And needless to say, they're all bumping into each other. Now, I'd like to leave a lot of time for questions and advice. And when I talk about the civil service of Ontario, I've worked with them over the years enough to know we're fortunate in being served by a lot of very dedicated people. But it's sometimes difficult for them to sort of get their collective acts together. But thank you for your attention, and I hope that we'll have an opportunity for somewhat of a discussion. And I...
a recurring theme when you sort of observe what's happening in the justice system is the delays and how long everything takes. You touched on it. Is any real progress being made, or if the facts were known, is the amount of time from when an action is taken and a decision is reached, in fact, expanding? Because when I talk to people who've been in litigious situations, they're not talking about months. They're talking sometimes 10, 11 years before a case comes to trial or any sort of finality. Is there any progress happening in that area as you know?
Well, I wish I could say that in my view there was significant progress. It's a very difficult issue. Justice Blair worked on the issue a few years ago, and very important report in trying to address these very significant challenges to the system. But I remember when the CEO of the Law Society of Upper Canada retired a year or so ago, and he, I think he's a lawyer, but in any event, it doesn't matter, but in one of his final interviews, he said, well, you know, the problem with the justice system and the problem with improving the justice system is that there's no one institution in charge. And he was correct. I mean, the independence of the judiciary, the independence of the bar, are of fundamental importance to the justice system. So it'd be nice if you could have kind of a sort of dictator in charge, kind of laying down the guidelines. But it's a unique system, and I think I know the legal profession wants to improve it, and I know there's been a number of studies, and those studies will continue. And there are probably other people in this room are better able than I am to suggest what are the obvious improvements. I mean, I can think of one that isn't accepted by the profession, and that is in civil actions, have a case assigned to a judge and keep and maintain that assignment to the end of the trial. This is very controversial in the profession in Ontario, but it is a strategy utilized in the U.S. and it avoids a lot of unnecessary repetition when it comes to arguments as somebody who has a history. But I think we've reached almost a crisis, notwithstanding the high quality of our judges, and that the government have to continue to give it a high priority.
Thank you, Roy, for your comments. You and I have had our ups and downs over the years, but I would be remiss if I did not, and I know I speak for many people here, salute you for your, I've known you 40 years, for your unbroken record of trying to make justice more equitable in this province and more accessible, as possible to disadvantaged people. It's a fine record. As would also be well known to many people here, I have had certain legal travails in the United States that have had their echo in this country. And I want to second what you said about the dangers of following some of the trends in that country. I wish I could agree that reducing the prison population is as high a priority in the United States as you implied. The sole reason that I can see at this point is budgetary. It's just become so horribly expensive for the United States to have, as it does, 6 to 12 times as many incarcerated people per capita as the roughly comparable countries, Canada, Australia, France, Great Britain, Germany, and Japan. It is not a commendable record for the country that is traditionally the leader of all of the countries that believe in individual liberties and due process, and it is a real problem there. My question of you is, I'll make one comment, if I may, and then ask a question. The comment is that, in my experience, the problem that you described of the desire for lawyers to operate a business, put simply, avarice. Everyone is entitled to an income, especially a learned professional who works hard and does his job well. But that problem, I think, is becoming steadily more serious. In my opinion, and my experience with distinguished lawyers in this jurisdiction is quite extensive, in my opinion, they are terribly preoccupied with billing. Obviously, they have to be paid, and they have to live, and they deserve to live quite well. But they are overly preoccupied with paying, and the whole system is fed inadvertently, not in an organized way, by this process by which there's a tremendous number of legislators and regulators steadily emitting a greater and greater number of regulations and laws with sanctions to them, requiring an ever-expanding legal community to deal with it. And it is... it is a cartel that does, in fact, perpetuate itself in ways that are sometimes questionably ethical, in my opinion. And I just wondered if you had a view on that. And secondly, you might be reluctant to do this, but you've expressed your views on the present federal government's crime position. I entirely agree with you. Would you care to, I mean, we're all unlicensed psychiatrists, would you care to impute a motive to that? Is it sincere belief that this will actually create a better and more just society, or is it a more politically oriented motivation? Thank you very much, Ron.
Conrad, I apologize that ego prevented me from wearing my hearing aids today, but I think I got all your question. I mean, I think the federal government, as far as their crime and punishment agenda, I think they're clearly on the wrong road. And I think it's clearly a political gamesmanship, a political... they know that it's not going to accomplish anything, but they also know that most people don't like crime, and I used to often say that the last refuge of a political scoundrel is to press the crime and punishment issue as a major issue facing society, and I still believe that. When it comes to professional fees, I mean, I said earlier in my remarks briefly, and this would probably be regarded by some of my friends in government as kind of a socialist initiative, but I really do believe that there are a lot of good lawyers who would be prepared to work for a salary, for a reasonable salary, if they believed that they were making a significant contribution to the community. And I believe that very strongly. I think it's, and I talk about it, but I don't get a whole lot of support from the profession. But I'm hoping that times will change and that there will be more emphasis on the legal profession as a helping profession. But again, thank you for your intervention, Conrad.
Thank you so much, Mr. McMurtry. It's a real honor to be in the same room with you, and very inspiring. This issue has already been raised, but there was recently a survey done, you may have heard of this, that showed that the majority of Canadians surveyed have lost faith in the justice system. And the primary reason for this was because of the delays and the incredible amount of time it takes for anything to be determined. And it, particularly as a citizen, watching a number of cases being tried in the United States, I don't know how the system functions down there, but I'm always shocked when it seems like somebody's been tried, convicted, or found innocent within the space of a few months of hearing about the crime in the news. Could you please speak to that a little bit more, if you will, if there's anything in the foreseeable future you can see that might happen to expedite things, since this does seem to be the primary problem, according to this survey, that most people have with the system? Thank you.
When I was Chief Justice of both the trial court and then of the Court of Appeal of Ontario, we used to have many meetings with our trial judges. And the message that I tried to bring them all, and I'm not being critical of anybody in particular because they're all, I regard them as good friends, but urging them to take more control over the conduct of their trial and to avoid the obvious wastes of time that are occurring on a frequent basis. But the trial judges, I think, generally are kind of a little, on occasion at least, intimidated by the Court of Appeal, who feel that if they interfere unduly in a trial, that this could lead to a new trial and additional expense to the parties. But I think with respect to our judiciary, that the culture has to change to the extent that judges are going to take more control over the proceedings in front of them. Now, we've got no shortage of judges around here, which would probably want to disagree with me.
Roy, I just want to change gears a little bit, but one thing I should say is I think most people in this audience would agree is there's no question that you are one of the greatest attorney generals in Ontario's history, and it's a great privilege having you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
One of the parts of your career you touched on very lightly at the very end, but I thought would be interesting to share with us here today is your period in London, England, when you were Canada's High Commissioner, and there are some very historic things that happened during that period with apartheid, which stands out as one of the great injustices ever in history. And I wonder if you'd mind commenting on your period in London and what you saw in terms of international issues, because clearly today, I mean, you look around the world, there's a lot of uproar and injustice and people's rights being trampled on, and you had a direct effect on a couple of very significant issues when you're in London. So I wondered if you'd be able to comment a little bit on that.
Certainly. Thank you, David. Well, certainly one thing I learned in arriving in London as a Canadian ambassador was that there was, generally speaking, in the diplomatic community, a tremendous respect for Canada and our reasoned, moderate approach to most issues. They regarded the Canadian position as usually being carefully thought out and balanced and reasonable. There are rumors that we're losing some of that. There are rumors that the Foreign Service in most governments, including the Canadian government, have always been a little bit resented as being the so-called creme de la creme, or in their own opinions at least. But I think generally we've been well served, but I think we can't assume that will continue. Now, of course, when I think of England and I think of my occasional battle with the Iron Lady, Margaret Campbell, but I've been doing a little since Margaret died. I've been rereading some books and other material I had. And while she was a tough person and perhaps could have benefited by a little more compassion, and I certainly, we disagreed with her stubbornness on South Africa, but when I think back on her, I think we'll be reading a lot more about her, and because without doubt she was one of the most remarkable women of her age. And when I think back, the fact that she became leader of the Conservative Party in 1975, I mean, that if anybody had bet on that happening, I mean, the odds would have been huge. And I mean, she was an incredibly strong person, and all the various books and whatnot that I've retained about Margaret or magazines, it's amazing to see all these photographs, dozens and dozens of them, and she's the only male in the photograph. So I think she did some good things. I didn't agree with her on South Africa, of course, and I think Brian Mulroney provided a lot of leadership there. That she and Ronald Reagan clearly believed that there could not be a change to democracy in South Africa without a very bloody civil war. And I personally think that if it was not for Nelson Mandela, that their expectations were probably accurate. And I think he's certainly one of the great men of history. But on the other hand, when we look at South Africa today, I think the Mandela and the ending of apartheid was an incredibly important step in their history. But they've got a long way to go to become a democracy in the sense that Nelson Mandela would have preferred. I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the High Commissioner's Committee on South Africa, which during my 3.5 years there, which brought me to Africa and South Africa. And it's an incredible story. But I think, Bill Conrad, I think maybe you're undertaking the challenge of writing the definitive biography of your friend Margaret Thatcher, but I think a lot more needs to be written, because I don't think, her skills and her toughness was truly recognized. I mean, she certainly honestly believed that she was twice as tough as any man. And she said that more than once in my presence. And therefore, you didn't see Margaret worried about advancing women in the cabinet in the senior positions, because she clearly thought that if the women wanted to exercise their talents, they could sort of outgun their male competitors. But it was a fascinating place to be at that time in London, and particularly during those years. And I think Canada's role in the fight against apartheid will go down as a very important role.
I was just wondering who you find, or what country you find as a point of inspiration. When you look at what could be, or what you would massively hope for, where do you turn to get those thoughts?
I look out my backyard. We're certainly not perfection, but I think we've taught the world a good deal about the sort of dealing with diversity and tolerance and respect for individual rights. And I think while we have some distance to go, we should be... I can't find any other country that I would prefer to emulate. Not that I wouldn't like to see certain improvements here, but that's a story for another campaign.
Thank you, Mr. McRoy. You mentioned about the recommendations that were written on behalf of the C.W. Jeffries shooting, and those books were a recommendation. Did you say 4 volumes, or did I misinterpret that?
Oh, our review of Roots of Youth Violence, half of the 4 volumes are research.
Okay.
And whatnot. So it's not a big, heavy read, but the executive summary, does represent a blueprint for municipalities across Ontario and I think across Canada.
Okay, my question is, when are they going to be truly implemented? And we are still having so many acts of violence in the areas like the Danzig one. And this past summer, we had a number of shootings up at Jane and Finch, young children. When I say young, in the 14, 15-year-old boys being killed. And who is responsible for putting a stop to that? Is it the police? Is it us? Is it social workers? The government? Who?
I think it's all of us have a different role. I mean, there are issues. I think we've got a very good police force in Toronto, but I think they mishandle many of the issues up in the Jane Finch area, and I think they harass young black people unnecessarily and unfairly, and they've created a lot of unnecessary hostility. And I think society as a whole, we all have a role to play. And sometimes I regret the fact that I suspect that people are so overwhelmed by the apparent magnitude of the challenge that they feel that no one person could do very much. I think there was a great book or movie written a few years ago called The Power of One. But I think what churches do, what you do to relieve the hungry and help people and perhaps go further to create mentoring programs. And I think we've got to do an awful lot more of that. Dan Lang and I were talking earlier about a mutual friend, Barry Wansra, who would be known to some of you in this room, who is a former football coach of Dan's, who created an organization called License to Learn, where they've established a network of schools where they actually have peer tutoring and mentoring, which has been a great success. And I've been asked to take over as the honorary patron from the late Lincoln Alexander. But if people look around, there's always something that can be done. There's always some person to be helped. And, so many people, as I quoted this judge who said, been behind the eight ball since day one. I remember hearing a very interesting interview on the CBC within the last month, and it had to do with a Texas attorney where, of course, they love to execute half the state, it would appear. But his specialty was he had a team of lawyers and volunteers, and his specialty was pleading for clemency at the last minute for these people who are on death row. And what interested me about his interview was he said that being Texas, of course, most of the appeals for clemency would be lost, and given the ugly culture down there. But he said the amazing thing was that they'd phone up these people who were scheduled to be executed. This is the last minute appeals subject to be executed and were within 24 hours or less. But the thing that stuck with him was that how many of these people would, when he'd phone them and say, it's all over, how many of them were incredibly grateful for the time and effort that his individuals had expended trying to help these people, because it had never happened to them before. And for the first time in their lives, these people on death row had run into people who really appeared to care for them, and it meant a lot. And the cynic could say, well, what did they have to lose at that stage? But I was very impressed by what he had to say, how important the influence of one person can be with respect to so many of these vulnerable and disadvantaged and people.
So on behalf of all your friends and admirers, we thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.